this is Neil Funk, and you're listening to Frick on the Chicago Bullseye.
Hello, this is Nick Friedel, and you're listening to Frick on the Chicago Bullseye. Hi, this is Chuck Swirsky, and you're listening to Frick on the Chicago Bullseye.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of Chicago Bullseye. We got stars galore this week. Ricky O'Donnell earlier this week, and now the great Kevin Anderson from NBC. How you doing, brother?
I'm good. By the way, are you and Ricky on like the exact polar opposites of the Bulls spectrum?
On a previous podcast, I had mentioned that at one time we were like so close we could hold hands. That was around 2011 or 12. When, you know, we were both anti-Heinrich. We were really simpatico. And I view him as kind of like, I'm Obi-Wan and he's Luke Skywalker. And if you recall, I was trying to paint this analogy. I don't know if he got it in the last podcast, but at the end of Empire Strikes Back, Vader's basically trying to get Luke to join him to overthrow the Emperor, to become, you know, a new duo of evil. And I think what happened is, Bulls blogger, obviously Vader, If you replay this, you know, this is him just agreeing to it, right? Instead of jumping off the platform, he says, "You know what? I'm down. Let's teach me the ways of the dark side." And do you sense, is that a pretty good analogy? I think that's right on.
It's more like you're Obi-Wan telling Anakin you were the chosen one, and you're upset by it, and now he's gone to the dark side. And you can't do anything about it. Like, you see that there's this light inside him that you feel like you can bring him back to the light side, but it's be a very long and difficult journey to get him to that
point. It is, though, but I find him incredibly frustrating because I think our friend from Australia, Mark, is kind of like the poor man's version also of Ricky O'Donnell in that they're both highly intelligent, but they take on the mouth breather sector of Bulls Twitter nation. You know, like defense wins championships, and all the you know, fire Gar Paxton, hire Tibbs. You know, that whole group, that whole segment, I kind of feel are just the guys that live, you know, in 1980, that eat beef jerky, you know, that say don't drink water when you run, and you know, play guys 44 minutes to just deny science. And that's why I find him so disturbing or frustrating, that he's just so anti, like he won't even recognize anything that they've done well. And I think he's just lost all hope and he's just embraced the darkness. I don't know. What say you?
Well, he's just embraced the dark side. I mean, I love Ricky. He's a fantastic writer, great person, very intelligent. And I think now the next time I see him, I'm just going to tell him you were the chosen one and just leave it there.
Exactly. Well, speaking of the chosen one, Zach LaVine tearing it up. My gosh, what a way to start out the season. I'd love to get your initial thoughts on him because I can't recall where you were at on the signing.
I was all about the signing. I loved it. I thought it was the right move at the time. It made sense from a financial point of view. It made sense from a skill set point of view. Like I when they signed him, I thought it was the right decision at the time. In fact, I initially, back last spring, expected him to sign for like 4 for $76. It is originally what I thought the contract would be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's obviously right there. So, I mean, the thing is about Zach, what is extremely encouraging about the way we've seen Zach play so far in these four games, it's not just about the scoring and the points. It's how he's getting those points.
Mm-hmm.
You look at a guy, Nico, and Nico's been on fire. And I know that's another kind of hot-button issue with Bulls fans, is how well Nico's playing. And I know my good friend Kendall Gill is still beside himself because he thought the Bulls should have never traded Nico. And you can make an argument for that. But the point is that Nico's getting so many of these points because he's shooting just on fire from three. Like, he's just been lights out. But the way Zach is getting his points is, it's not like he's just in the super hot streak and he's going to regress back to the mean and go back to, like, you know, the low 20s just because it eventually is going to even out. Zach's points are coming because he's getting to the free throw line, he's being aggressive on offense, and he is not actually shooting that well for distance right now. He's not. He's shooting like 25%.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually make the argument that the scoring average he's got right now, that he's going to continue that for the rest of the season, and that we're going to see Zach average 30 points a game this season. The only thing that is going to derail that is an injury, or when Lauri Markkanen comes back, if it gets to the point where Markkanen's taken away from Zach's shots. But to be honest, I don't think that's the case. I think when Lauri comes back, we're certainly going to need Markkanen to get his shots. But I think Markkanen's shots are going to come at the expense of Jabari, Dunn, and a couple of the other guys. Zach is still going to get his shots. And the thing is, Zach is not getting 35 points on 35 shots. And so, like, right. he's playing at a James Harden-type game of getting to the free-throw line, being aggressive, and hitting his free throws. It's fantastic to see. Like, there's no reason to think this won't continue.
No, I agree 100%. He's actually taken on, like, a Jimmy Butler type of game, where a lot of his points are coming from attacking the basket and getting to the free-throw line. And his three-point, you're absolutely right, his three-point percentage is up to 40% now, somehow, I think, just because he had I think he had a good night last night from three. I can't recall.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you're right. He hasn't shot it really well from three. What he's been doing so well is attacking the rim, and that's something we really didn't see at all last year, with the notable exception of the game against Minnesota. And that comes with just feeling more comfortable with your knee. So, you know, that's what's so exciting about this whole thing, is that I think we actually have a better version who's, you know, of almost potentially. I'm not saying he's never going to approach Butler in the defensive end. But offensively, their games are very similar in terms of attacking the rim when they're at their best. Except he's able, I think, obviously, to shoot much better. So, really exciting.
Yeah, he's a superior offensive player than Jimmy. He's a better offensive player than Jimmy. There's no question. Jimmy's elite defensively, and Zach is a long ways from even being average defensively. But he's absolutely a better offensive player than Jimmy is.
I think our friend Luke Skywalker, a.k.a. Ricky O'Donnell, will take issue with that. I mean, he's one of the guys who's still – you're on my side, right? The trade was an absolute fleecing, and it happened – you know, where was the line for that? I always make the joke. The line was when Tibbs was waiting and you know, to go through the line at Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport to fly out to L.A. to meet with him. I mean, that's pretty much when it was done. That trade was, we just absolutely fleeced him. I mean, just Markkanen alone, I think you can even make the argument right now that LaVine alone, we won the trade, and then we got those three, including Dunn. It's over. There's no debate. What say you?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And the thing is, the trade was the right decision at the time. It's the right decision now. And in terms of the mythical who won the trade, to me, it's absolutely clear that the Bulls won the trade. I mean, there's no question in my mind that the Bulls won the trade. And, yeah, they got lucky with Markkanen, and certainly with Carter to a certain extent, with him falling there and getting what we hoped is to be a future star in Wendell Carter. But in terms of the actual trade itself, the thing is, what other people sometimes like to do is judge a trade in a vacuum. And you can't do that, because the Bulls, who they were without the trade, before the trade, they were a mediocre basketball team. That's all they were. They're absolutely mediocre. And they, as in the words of Paxton, they had to pick a lane, and they did. And if they don't make the trade, they never get probably Wendell Carter the following year. They certainly don't get Zach LaVine. They don't get Lauri Markkanen. Mm-hmm. And where are we as the franchise right now? Exactly. We are just stuck in purgatory hell with this team, with probably an unhappy Jimmy Butler, who's going to force his way out, just like he's trying to do in Minnesota, because Butler wants a supermax extension. And we knew all along the Bulls were never going to give him that max extension. It was not going to happen. That's one of the reasons the whole trade happened in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so you right now, can you imagine the situation we'd be in if what Jimmy is trying to force Minnesota to do, if he was trying to force it to the Bulls?
I agree.
And then 1 year later, the Bulls had to make a trade. They'd have absolutely little, and not incentive is the word I'm looking for. They'd absolutely have a little value in that they get back from him. They couldn't get anything back for Jimmy right now if they tried to trade him. Like, I think if Minnesota tries to trade Jimmy, you don't expect a huge haul. Like, Jimmy has now, you know, under a season left on his deal, and they're not going to get anything close to what the Bulls got for him a year and change ago on draft night when they made that deal. And so, like, it's a completely no-brainer to me that the Bulls won that trade.
I agree 100%. Like, because we also forget the agreement that he'd be able to sign in Chicago would be the supermax, the insane amount of money,
yeah.
Which would just really ruin our flexibility. And so our only hope would be that, you know, Portis and these guys that we drafted, you know, in the second half, Valentine, you know, 15 and above in the first round would develop into something, and that Jimmy would be able to recruit somebody big to Chicago. That's the argument you'll hear. Well, I don't know if that's true. I mean, if he's not going to be able to recruit and get the job done, you know, with Kyrie Irving, who's he going to recruit? He doesn't even want to play with LeBron. I don't understand the whole game plan going forward. Well, we should have done better. And the fact is, I thought the Bulls should have been better. Nico Mirotic, people wax poetic about him. We had Nico Mirotic, and I know Wade gets a lot of abuse, but the fact is he had an 18 PR that year, and he had averaged 18 points in 30 minutes per game at the two-guard position. You're going to find a lot worse than that in a lot of places. So I just didn't think the team did as well as it should have been. And Rondo, who's obviously a valuable player, I think the team should have been better. We'll argue about that some other time. I do want to get into this, though, because I think it's an important issue about this team going forward. So the team is without Lauri Markkanen, arguably our best player, our best three-point shooter in Valentine, and our best defender in Dunn for 4 to 6 weeks. And I don't care if it's Golden State. You take off the three best players, rotation players, and you know, the best player, the best defender, and the best three-point shooter, any team is going to suffer. So do you concur that when those three guys are back, and Portis now, obviously, this team's going to be much more competitive, and would you feel that they're a playoff-caliber team at the 7 or 8 seed in the East when those guys are back?
The problem is that when we get to that 4 to 6 week window, which it's kind of just a weird coincidence that all three guys are out the same length of time, that certainly by late December. I have a feeling that Markkanen's return is going to be held back a little bit just because of the injury, and I think they want it to be 110%, if you will, before he plays. Like, it's not going to be a situation where his elbow feels like it's 80% and he's going to play, right?
Sure.
But the issue is, what is their record going to be at that point? Let's say it's 25 games into the season. Let's say it's 22 games into the season, right? A nice little quarter, almost a quarter mark. They're 22 games into the season. What is their record going to be, given what this team is right now at the 22 game mark?
Mm-hmm.
And right now, to me, it's conceivable they're looking at 5-17 at the 22 game mark right now with the who they have and who they're missing, and it would be impossible for them to make up that deficit. They'd have to play just lights out. Like, they can't play 8-seed basketball for the last three quarters of the season and then get the 8-seed when you start 5-17. Like, you'd have to play like top 3-seed basketball to get the 8-seed after that deficit. And so, to me, yes, when they come back, I think they will be a competitive team. I think they will be a close to 500 team when completely healthy. But the problem is the deficit's going to be so big that I think the playoffs right now, it would take something just really a miracle almost for them to be an 8-seed given that deficit. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So let's say they go 5-17. That's 22 games. That means they would have to go 500 the rest of the way, which I think is eminently doable. That's what I expected the team to be this year if everybody was healthy. If we didn't have these vast amount of injuries to rotation players, I expected them to be right around 41 wins. And let's say they go 30-30 west away, so that's 37 wins. That's not going to get you the 8 seed. It's going to be close, though. And that's the worst-case scenario. I mean, if you finish ninth, that's what we do not want. So this is going to be a really tough decision, and I think you're right. I think we really need to analyze, are we going to be 5-17 when these guys come back? Because if so, then it's time to tank. But if they surprise us like they did last night, I mean, we could easily won the Pistons game. And let's say they're 7, you know, let's say they're 7 and, you know, 15 or something, right around there.
Yeah.
I think you go for it. I think you go for it because I think you'll see enough signs. I mean, we did not expect, none of us expected LaVine to play this well. No doubt. He's third in the league in scoring. And I think we all agree that Markkanen's got a great future. We all love Wendell Carter Jr. I mean, I'm not a believer in that we need a tank again. I think we have the core of a team here that can challenge for a title in a few years, especially with, I think, how good Hutchinson has been. I'd like to get your opinion on that statement, Hutchinson. Give your take on Hutchinson and Wendell Carter Jr. so far this year.
Well, first off, about the whole tanking aspect, the good thing is that with the lottery reform and the way it's being implemented this year, is that actually gives the Bulls more time to make a decision about it, right? Yeah. Like, it's not like they have to finish with the worst record in the league. You just need to be in the bottom four, and you've got the same percentage as the other three teams. So when it comes down to it, what they're really going to do as an organization is see where they are when all these three guys are back, when Lowry, Portis, and Dunn are healthy and on the court. They'll see what their record is, and then see what they are a month after that. And so really, you don't need to truly make an organizational decision about that until mid-January, maybe even late January, because if you're going to be truly awful and you can, if you do end up 5-17, 3-19, something just terrific, it's not like you need to play catch up and end up with the worst record in the league. Mm-hmm. You know, it's also a really difficult position to be in from an organization because they didn't expect to be in tank mode again. And regardless of what you think from the front office you should do, the players are never going to tank. You don't tell players not to. It's how you approach your roster, what you do with trades, what you do with injuries. That's how organizations tank. Players are not going to. And so regardless of how you feel as a team, if Markkanen is healthy, and LaVine is healthy, and Portis is healthy, and Carter continues to progress, they're going to be a competitive team, whether you like it or not. And ultimately, I think that's what's best for everybody, is that they get experience, they be competitive. And, you know, if you were to ask me 3 weeks ago what I thought was best for this organization, I think a 7 or 8 seed is better than a top three pick, just because I think the value of those playoff games for those specific players, for the young core, is better than a hypothetical top three pick that you may not get. You know, with the lottery reform, it's certainly better in terms of you have more time to make a decision. But you could end up, hypothetically, with 10 wins on the year and get the 6th pick the way the reform is now. And so, like, really, what is the incentive? I mean, you saw what Dallas went through last year with that. You know, like, what is really the incentive to have a complete awful year for your fan base, for your team, for your entire organization, and end up with a 6th pick? I mean, that's a punch in the gut. And so, try to win. Just try to win.
Sixth pick is Mo Bamba. But go on.
Yeah. Yeah, and so back to Hutchinson and Carter. Hutchinson has seen increased playing time in the last two games, and it's been good to see. His dunk last night on Wednesday night was fantastic, and I'd like to see that explosiveness from him. I want to see him play a little more active on defense, and my big concern with Hutchinson is his shot release seems to me to be extremely slow for this level. Mm-hmm. He needs to work on a quicker release. And I think that's going to be an issue for a little while for him. But they need him in this rotation right now. They absolutely need him. And, you know, I think you're going to see probably Parker start at the four while Portis is out. And, you know, Hutchinson's going to be a big part of that rotation on the wing. Like, he's going to have to step up, and I hope he can do it. And regarding Carter, certainly his offensive game needs to be developed a little bit more. But I'm happy what I see out of him defensively. And, you know, I think we've got a potential, you know, really, really good player. I'm not going to say he's a star yet or a potential star, but I really like what I see out of Wendell Carter. He's impressed me so far, and you know, just literally a week into the season, and what we saw from him in the preseason, And he's a rookie. I don't want to expect too much from him. I think what we got out of Laurie last year was clearly above the norm for that. But I've got a lot of hope in what Carter can be.
I agree 100% on Carter. Back to Hutchinson, I was at the last preseason game against Denver, and he played very well in that fourth quarter. He had a dunk with a few seconds left on the clock that the few people that were still left in the arena, I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely phenomenal. It was as good as anything I've seen all year as far as athletic ability and just hammering it down. We saw a little bit of that last night. So I am really starting to get excited about Chandler Hutchinson because I know for one thing he's already a better defender than Justin Holliday. I think Justin Holliday, I don't understand why he gets this reputation. He's a good defender. He's not. He's terrible. He's not strong enough to get around picks. He's just, Holliday's a good off-the-bench guy, seventh or eighth guy. But when you put him in a starting role, his numbers actually look pretty decent this year shooting-wise. But I think it was you who pointed out when he plays well. I can't remember where I saw it, but when he plays well, the Bulls will win. When he doesn't, they don't have a shot. And he actually had a terrible night last night, which is encouraging, and the Bulls managed to win that game. I want to talk about Jabari Parker already because his numbers have been stellar so far this year. He's shooting 46% from the field, 41.7% from three, 80% from the free throw line, second on the team in scoring. Obviously, his defense, he's never going to be a world beater on that end of the court, but I think he's, especially in the last two games, played extremely well. Facilitating passing is such an underrated trait of his. Are you ready to say once Portis comes back inside with Kendall and myself that, hey, Parker needs to be, if we're just talking about the four position, Parker needs to be reinserted in the starting lineup?
Playing the power forward, maybe. Here's the thing with me on Parker. I think part of his reason of his success so far this year is because he's playing with the second unit. I love what he's bringing with that because you look at the lineup he's out there with, he's the primary scorer, and I think that's where he needs to be and that's where he needs to shine. I think when you talk about Portis coming back, the issue is that Portis is going to come back at the same time Markkanen is going to come back. So unless we're talking about a situation in which Markkanen has a setback and then is out several more weeks or longer, you know, it's kind of a moot point just because Markkanen is going to be healthy at the same time Portis is, certainly within a few days of the current projections with that. And so you're never going to start Jabari at the four over Markkanen, and I still think Jabari at the three is the wrong decision. And that's, you know, I give Fred's taken a lot of heat. Fred took a lot of heat for his defensive lineup against the Pistons on that last possession, and rightfully so, because he should have had Carter out there. But he's done some things really right in terms from a rotation standpoint, and one of the things he's done really right is starting Carter over Lopez and starting Portis at the four and bringing Parker on the bench with the second unit. And so I still, you know, during this current stretch, I think we'll see Parker at the four because I think that's where he needs to be. But all things equal and everything healthy, I still think Parker off the bench is the right decision for that. And I think that is better for Parker and better for the team. Jabari may not think that. Jabari certainly wasn't happy when he was told he was going to come off the bench. The whole no comment reaction to that certainly speaks volumes. But in terms of his production, I think he's better with that second unit because I don't think he has to worry about having to share shots. I mean, let's be honest. When Zach, Markkanen, and Parker are on the floor at the same time, Parker is the third mouth to feed for that. Yeah. And his numbers are going to drop significantly in that situation. But if he's getting 12 to 15 minutes a game where he doesn't have those other two out there, at least one of the other two out there at the same time, that's when he can really put up some points and give that second unit a much-needed injection of offense. And so I'm still, given this current stretch is a little bit different because of injuries, but all things equal, I still like him on the bench.
I'm going to stand in Jabari Hill for a second here. You would agree that he's a better three-point shooter than Portis, right? Clearly.
Yes, I mean, I think that's so clear. Yeah.
You would also agree he's clearly a better passer. I think his passing in this point forward position the last two games have been stellar. You'd agree there, right?
He's been very good.
So yeah. I just think that type of player would be better off with Levine. And I think we saw it in Q4 yesterday. I thought they played really well together at the end of that game. You know, I still maintain, and I think the worst player on this team to pair with Parker is Blakeney. I just he's just a shoot first guy that they do not mesh well together. And I think the one good thing about Fred is he's kind of removed those two on the court at the same time. And then, I wrote that article about this where I thought it was a mistake. And I know Kendall is the only person who agreed with me on it. But, you know, you had a guy in Portis that embraced the six-man role, who wanted that role, and you created a problem you didn't mean to have. You know, I've kind of made this argument ad nauseum, so I don't want to do it anymore. But I would like to get your opinion on this, because this is what I would do if I was GM. I would, and this is going to be very difficult now that Portis got hurt, but I would have traded Portis this year. I would have found a way to trade him. You can't have Portis, Parker, and Markkanen on the same roster. Just not going to work. You got three fours that are basically all playing the same position really well. And I would trade him, and I would seriously think of picking up that option on Parker next year. I know this won't happen. They're probably going to let him go. What do you think of that idea of siding with Parker, the 23-year-old, and trading Portis, and then running going forward next year with Markkanen and Parker as the lead off the bench?
Well, see, the issue with picking up the option on Parker is they have to make that decision before July 1st. I don't know the exact date. It's probably like June 28th, somewhere around that mark, that they've got to make the decision on Parker's team option.
Okay.
So you would have to make that decision before the moratorium started, before you could talk to free agents. And so you would go into it and going, you know, hypothetically, you could pick up the option on Parker, and if you don't bring back Payne, and if you don't bring back Portis, depending where your draft pick was, you could maybe get to a max contract for one guy.
Okay.
Maybe. It would really depend on where they were drafting in terms of that spot. But right now, in fact, I have it because I put the numbers out last night. So if you go to my Twitter account, Kevin_MBCS, I actually have my projection for their cap spot next summer with their current roster and how much space they would have if they picked up the option on Parker and if they didn't pick up the option on Parker. And so if they didn't pick up the option on Parker, they could maybe get to a max slot. They'd have to be a little creative. They'd have to stretch the numbers of Ashik's $3 million guaranteed, not bring back Payne, not bring back Portis, and you can maybe get there. But I think as an organization, I think it's very unlikely they pick up that option on Parker. And here's the other reason why you wouldn't do it is you would only do it if you thought he was going to get more than $20 million in free agency.
If you thought,
right?
Portis,
so
was?
Parker.
Okay.
So you would only pick up the team option on Parker if you felt like he was going to get more than $20 million in free agency.
Oh, I see.
Or if you wanted to keep your cap space intact for 2020 and you wanted essentially Parker on another one-year deal. Those are the two reasons you would do that. But if you didn't pick up the option of Parker, you could still re-sign Parker. Like, if you felt like Parker was truly the answer, you could still re-sign him even though you didn't pick up the option. And you actually might save yourself money, because if Parker on the open market is only going to get 15 a year, then why pick up the team option
for
him on 20?
Good point. Yeah, that's the question. If he keeps on scoring like this, I mean, if he averages somewhere between 16 and 20 points per game, I think there's a good chance somebody would throw out 20. But you're right. Right now, as a sixth man, there's no way he's going to get that. It's a tough question. How would it go if they wanted restricted free agent status for Portis? Would they be able to sign a free agent before you'd have to match anything on? I guess it depends on how quickly he gets an offer.
Yeah, so they, exactly right. So Portis is a restricted free agent. With just like Levine, what they would do is they would essentially keep, wait and see what happens with them. Now, you'd have what's called a cap hold on the books for Portis by doing that. And I think his cap hold's around $9 million. I have to double check what I've got for that. But essentially what that means is you've got to account for that cap hold for Portis with any free agent signing that you do. And so it's essentially as if you're paying Portis that cap hold, and you can't go over the salary cap while accommodating that cap hold. And so you could still, if you didn't bring back Parker, which is certainly the most likely thing that Parker is not going to be back next season, if you didn't bring back Parker, you'd actually have, even with Campaign's cap hold and Bobby Portis' cap $33 million in cap space next year.
Wow.
So, yeah. So like, for instance, Portis's cap hold is actually 7.4, that's 7.5 if you round up, number for next summer. And so they could do what they did with Levine. They could wait and see on Portis, and then they could, you could hypothetically, let's say they don't bring back Parker, they'd have $33 million in cap space. I'm not saying they're going to sign him, but let's say Kawhi Leonard wants to play in Chicago.
Yes.
He loves it, right?
Yes.
You could sign Kawhi Leonard and then go over the salary cap to re-sign Portis by matching an offer with him, as long as you accommodated for that cap hold in your original amount. And so they've got some flexibility there, and I think that's what they're going to do with Bobby, is they're just going to wait and see what Bobby gets on the open market and make a decision. And they've got a number in mind in which they either won't match or will match. And, you know, certainly, Bobby has struggled a little bit so far this season. He's clearly now out for a significant amount of time. His jump shot has not been in there. And I think he's feeling the pressure of playing essentially a one-year deal. Like, he knows that his chance for a big payday is in 9 months. And he's, I think, putting a little too much pressure on himself for that. It's understandable, because with all these players, their truly big contract comes off that rookie deal, and that's where Bobby is right now. And so, you know,
Parker's,
I get where he's coming from.
Really, too, you know, Parker's in the same situation when you really analyze.
Parker's in the same spot. He's on a 1 year deal essentially too, and he wants to get paid. And so, my concern is, from a team, from a fan, is that we're going to get into February, and the team's going to be clearly out of the playoff race by that point. And you're going to have two players who are then incentivized to get their own personal numbers up. And that could be an issue. Like, that is going to be a significant issue for Fred come February with Parker and certainly with Portis. And so he's got to find a way to make everybody happy. And if Levine's still averaging 30 points a game at that point and Markkanen's playing well, you could have a very tough dynamic on your hands.
Yeah, I'm a little confused why people don't like Parker a little more than Portis. I just feel like I like Bobby as a – well, I'm not confused. Bobby has intensity, a lot of those intangibles that we all love and that I love. I love everything about him besides his complete lack of jumping ability or athleticism, and he's never going to be a good defender. He's just not. He's not quick enough. He's not, doesn't have lateral quickness. You could make the same argument about Parker, but where I like Parker more is his versatility in his offensive game. Just a better three-point shooter, a better passer, and I love it when he takes it a hoop. And Parker's one of the best bigs in transition in the league. He's fantastic in transition. And Bobby's just not as fast. He doesn't have the gifts
transition.
He does. He doesn't have the skills he does. And you know, he's shooting 27.3% from three. You just can't have a big who can't hit the three when Zach LaVine's your first or second best player. You got to pull that guy out. Nobody's coming out to worry about Bobby Portis shooting threes. I mean, he showed the ability to do it last year, but you know, the difference between 38% and 36% is massive, absolutely massive. And when, you know, the best team in the league shoots it at 38, the worst shoots it at 33. And, you know, I think Bobby's the guy we got to try to turn into some other type of asset. But you're right. You touched on something. I'm going to say, I'd like your opinion on this. Dunn at the one, Levine at the two, Markkanen at the four, and you got WCJ at the five. We got to just, if we can drop Kawhi, Durant, or Klay Thompson, or one of those guys in at the three, that team is ready to rock and roll. And that's a challenge. That's a top three team in the East. Do you disagree? Next year.
You know what the huge irony in all of this is?
Oh,
who's actually, other than Kawhi, who's the actually perfect player to play at the three?
Wouldn't that, hold on a second. I actually made that case. I go, wouldn't it be hilarious if Gar Paxson came up with this huge, massive plan to take advantage of Tibbs couple years ago and agreed that too often. You're absolutely right. Jimmy Butler, right? Jimmy Butler at
yes.
the three? Oh my God,
like,
I love
it. It's astounding because he fills two huge holes. He fills the hole at the position and he fills the hole of wing defense that they sorely lack on this team. And so that's the huge irony of that. It'll never happen. It's not going to happen. But it's just, it's really funny when you think about it. But to answer your question, yeah, that's the one spot that they really need to focus on free agency. And Kawhi is the perfect guy for that. But the problem is they've never been able to sign that 1A top-tier free agent. We've gotten the second tier free agents, like Gasol and Boozer. We've never gotten that top tier guy. And so that's going to be the difficult decision about what they do this summer. And, you know, I know a lot of fans, depending on what happens in New Orleans, a lot of fans would love to see them trade for Anthony Davis. But that's a whole longer discussion for another podcast by the way, real quick, you're probably going to ask this anyway, but regarding the team as we have it right now, the guys who are healthy on this team, I want to see Zach LaVine run point, and I want to see Campaign on the two-guard spot.
Amen.
Campaign is a much better player catching and shooting and when he doesn't have the ball in his hands. Like he's actually a very good scorer when he's not trying to create his own shot. Like when he's running around screens and putting up shots, he's actually pretty good.
I agree. I agree 100%. Yeah, we're very simpatico on a lot of things, I think, and I agree 100% on this. I think people are just, they're over a, you know, Payne, I always said, is the manifestation of Garpax at their worst with, the, you know, the trade from McDermott. But now, I mean, if he keeps on playing like this, I think that's going to look like a good move in the long run. You know, if he can be a contributing player, there's a lot of time between now and then to make that decision.
But yeah, you're never going to start Payne over Dunn when Dunn's healthy, but Payne has become the embodiment of the dislike for Gar and Pax. I mean, he is the caricature tank commander. I mean, that's just what he's become. Well, but what we saw from him Wednesday night, and he, when you do something that Jordan never did, like you got to go, okay, well, that's kind of pretty cool, right?
He's got talent.
I know it's only for one half, but that's still damn pretty damn cool.
Well, Kev, I mean, he shot 38% from three last year, which is that's good. I didn't think he played bad last year. I thought he was a good backup point guard last year, but you know, that was a lot. People weren't paying attention by that time of the year when he was playing decent. To wrap this up, man, you've been more than generous with your time, and we love having you on the Bullseye. We got anybody want to turn this off now? You can, because we're going to talk a little Star Wars. Let's talk a little Star Wars.
Now's the time to turn it on. What do you mean? Just skip ahead to this point in the podcast. In reality, I'd approach it.
All right, so I got some serious questions here, and this is a big one. I got a young nephew, young niece, another nephew on the way. What order would you recommend for children to view the movies? And I want to ask you if you've noticed this phenomena of children enjoying episode 1 through 3 more than 4 through 6.
So I've got twin boys who are 6 years old.
Oh, great.
And so I've got, they're right in that time frame. And so with them, we did what's called the machete order, which is not sequential 1 through 8 now, and it's not completely how they originally aired in theaters. So you still start with episode 4, New Hope, and then you do Empire right after that, because you still want to keep the Vader's Luke's father reveal in that moment. It's very important to keep that surprise because it's such a defining moment for everybody who's seen Star Wars.
Yes.
And so if you start with episode 1 and go all the way through, that moment becomes so much less impactful. So I still recommend start with episode 4, then go to episode 5, go to Empire Strikes Back. And then after Empire Strikes Back, go to the prequels. Go to episode 1, then 2, then 3, then go back to
Return of
Jedi.
I love it.
Yeah, Return of the Jedi.
I haven't heard this before.
Do that as your order. It still keeps it intact. And here's the other more, you know, devious side of doing it that way. They'll fall in love with the original trilogy, or the original trilogy first, and not the prequels, because you don't want them becoming Star Wars fans going, Jar Jar is the best thing.
I agree 100%. It's the worst feel, and I've had that. I've experienced that where people, because, you know, 1 through 3 has some, you know, not great, but there's some interesting cinematography, you know, it's all computer generated, but, and then you go to 4, it's a little bit jarring, right? It's not, it's a 1970s technology, right? So there's a lot of negativity there. I'd like to go, you touch on something I don't think any millennials will ever realize, like what we did, is I was really young when I saw Empire Strikes Back, but I still remember the moment when he revealed that.
Everybody does.
And then, I don't know if this was your case, I didn't believe it. Like, I went 2 years Like, what? That can't be true. Like, did you feel that way, or did you really come to the realization watching the movie that this is true? He's really his father.
I felt like in the moment it was true. I felt like he was, like, the way Luke reacted, I was like, oh my God, Luke goes, you know? And so I never went through until Jedi came out going, oh, you know, what if it's not true? I just, you know, I probably at that point, I was 7 years old, so I probably was, you know, had discussions with my friends about it, maybe. That's a long time ago, so I don't remember that. But I think I remember thinking, all right, this is true. I took it as gospel. And one of the other kind of interesting parallels about that is what a lot of fans are going through right now in regards to Rey and if Kylo Ren was telling the truth with Rey's parents.
Oh, great.
Because
point.
There is still a significant part of the fan base who wants Rey's parents to be someone notable. Like,
right.
You know, they want Obi-Wan to be her grandfather, or they want her parents to be someone we've known before, or, you know, exiled Jedi or something like that. And so there is still a big chunk of the fan base who is like, I don't know if I believe Kylo Ren in that discussion. So it's kind of an interesting parallel what we have now compared to exactly what you went through, you know, in the early 80s in that time period. But getting back to one more thing about the love for the prequels from kids. And so my boys, if you ask them, hey, do you guys want to watch a movie today? I mean, we're talking any movie, not just any Star Wars movie, but if you want to watch a movie today, they will say Return of the Jedi is what they want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Because they love that film and they love the Ewoks. Like,
really?
They think the Ewoks are just like the coolest thing ever. And that's why George Lucas put him in there. Like, you know, we know he's a smart man and that's why he did that. But getting back to the prequels, is they haven't seen Episode 3.
Oh, wow.
They haven't seen Revenge of the Sith.
It's a heavy
the reason
one.
Is they don't want to watch it because they love Anakin and Obi-Wan as friends. Like, they watched all the Clone Wars cartoon. They watched clearly Episode 1 and 2.
Okay.
And they know that Anakin becomes Darth Vader, and they know that Anakin turns into Darth Vader in Revenge of the Sith. So it's not like they don't know it. They do know it, and they don't want to see it happen because in their minds, Anakin and Obi-Wan are best friends, and that they're partners, and that they're brothers. And they don't want to see the downfall of that relationship. And so
yeah.
they refuse to watch Episode 3, even though it's actually the best of the prequels. They don't
right.
want to watch it because
yeah.
of that. They don't want to see Anakin and Obi-Wan fight because they're best friends. So
the,
it's just like a
yeah.
cool little, you know, part of their brains and how they kind of view things. So I'm like, you know what? I can respect that. That's totally cool.
So I have a 10-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter, and surprisingly, my son does not share my love for Star Wars. My daughter loves it. And I'm just trying to figure out how I failed him. I don't understand how he didn't jump on there.
That's all right. You're one for two. You hit you're shooting 50%. That's still pretty
he
good.
He does understand the importance of Ben Gordon, though, which is good, and Tony Kukoc.
Yeah. So
I have succeeded there. You got a few more minutes? Because I want to touch on Star Wars Episode 9 real quick. You got
yeah, absolutely.
So I didn't even think about what you said, and that's a great parallel to, you know, is Rey's father or something. So I'm of the camp that Rian Johnson just is a disaster, and the more I watch Episode 8, the more angrier I get. You know, this baby was teed up perfectly. I mean, Abrams put it on a tee in Episode 7. I know it's time to hit a homer. And every time I watched last year, the first time I watched it, I left the theater. Oh, it was okay. I mean, I loved the scene in the throne room. That was great. But everything else, I got so angry. And every watching since, I've just gotten angrier and angrier. So do you feel, two questions, do you feel Abrams is going to make Rey's parents? There's no doubt Rian Johnson, if he was given Episode 9, he made them nobody, which is just a big waste of my time because I spent, you know, days talking about who they were. Do you feel Abrams is going to change that and make them someone? And if so, who would that be?
So, first off, I will, on the record, contend I loved The Last Jedi.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, I love it. Like, what Rian Johnson did with the franchise was sorely needed. And I, like, even I've seen the film, because I have it on Blu-ray, I've seen it probably, like, 5 times now. It gets better. every time I watch it. Like, I love The Last Jedi.
I can't
believe it. I'm all about it.
Can I ask you, really quick, did you agree, all right, spoiler alert, everyone, turn it off if you haven't seen it yet. Did you agree with killing off Luke?
In that moment, it made sense. I mean, like, Luke made the ultimate sacrifice to save his friends, to save his sister, to save the Resistance by doing that. Like, it took so much out of him. He had closed himself off from the Force for so long because of what happened with his nephew and his academy. I mean, the thing is, one of the big criticisms that I've heard about The Last Jedi is they don't feel like Luke would have ever reacted the way he did to what happened, right? Like there's a good friend of mine.
Luke didn't. Hamill didn't.
Hates Luke's character arc in that. But when you get down to it, throughout all the other films, Luke is emotional, Luke is reactive, and if he was in a situation in which there was essentially peace across the galaxy, and he had started a new Jedi Academy, and his nephew, I mean, his sister's and Han's kid, turned on him and killed all the other students, and the ones he didn't kill, he turned to the dark side and made parts of Knights of Ren. If that happened, if everything had been wiped out, and that's how I think Luke would have reacted. Like, I think Luke would have completely shut down and gone off to a remote Jedi temple on an island, on a planet no one's ever heard of, and shut himself off. Like, I can 100% buy that Luke would react that way. Like, that's who Luke was, an emotional character throughout all the films, and he was a reactive character. And so, in that moment, I could see him making that decision and doing it. And then he closes himself off from the Force, because he doesn't want any parts of Obi-Wan or Yoda in his head. He just wants to live on this island and just die in peace and be done with it and have the Jedi Order become no more. Like, I get it. Like, here's the other thing. Luke didn't leave clues for Han and Leia and even Kylo to come find him. Like, he didn't want to be found. Like, there's a little bit of misconception that he left, like, these breadcrumbs that he wanted to be found. No. Leia and Han and everybody else was just smart enough to figure out, all right, Luke's been isolated, he's gone, where would he go? There's a good chance he would probably go to the very first, oldest Jedi temple we ever heard of. And that's probably where he went to. And so they were just hoping to find him on Ochto. And they did. And so, like, I'm totally fine with Luke's character arc. And I love that he essentially spent all of his Force energy having this projection on Krait to buy enough time to teach Kylo a lesson that he still hasn't learned, and to buy enough time for all his friends to get out so the Resistance could live on. I'm okay with that.
We're
going to see him. We're going to see him in this next episode.
Oh, I know,
episode.
But it's not
going to
be,
see him.
It's not going to be anywhere near how cool it could have been if he was physically there. And that's what I don't buy. I don't buy that he physically would not have left the island with her to help out Leia. Yeah, obviously it sacrificed his life, this new Force power that none of us ever heard of in Star Wars. And the other thing that really bothers me, the big hole in there, is when he goes out there, he doesn't tell anybody. Finn wanted to come sprinting out to help him, right? He would have gone out and been wiped out. All those guys would have ran out to help out Luke, and then you know, they just figured out, wait a second, you know, the spark, and he goes, let's go look in the back and find a way out of here. It just was so utterly ridiculous, that part, that Finn wanted to run out and help fight with Luke. Can you imagine that? Finn goes, runs out, starts blasting the things, and then he realizes, oh, you're just an apparition. Boom. I mean, come on. You got to...
Well, I mean, you probably, in that moment, Luke probably would have used some Force portion and gotten Finn out of there. You know, like, that wouldn't have helped things. But here's the other thing about The Last Jedi, that one of the things I appreciated is one of the big criticisms of The Force Awakens is that it was too much like A New Hope. You know, I like The Force Awakens. It's a very good film. And it was, a lot of people were like, oh, it's still much like A New Hope. It's the same, you just got a bigger Death Star. You know, it's hitting the same beats, and, you know, and I get that. And so what Rian Johnson did was a complete 180. Every single point in The Last Jedi that was like a crossroads in the plot or for a character went the opposite way I thought was going to happen. Like, it went the complete opposite. You know, it starts with Luke taking the lightsaber from Rey and throwing it over his shoulder. No one in a million years thought that was going to happen.
I thought it was
so
terrible.
Every decision in the film that they made was going the complete opposite. Now, did it go in the opposite a little too much? Yeah, you could argue that. But like, it re-energized the franchise. And you, when you get to the eighth film in a franchise, in a series, and it is certainly if you add in Rogue One and Solo, you're talking about 10 films in the franchise now. You need to do something different. It has to be different. And that's what Rian Johnson did. And yes, to answer your original question, I think there is a good chance that J.J. Abrams comes back in Episode 9 and changes that specific point about Rey's parentage, because it's clear to me what Abrams was doing in regards to that plot point, Rian Johnson didn't follow up on at all. There were a lot of clues that Abrams left, like the X-Wing pilot helmet that was in Rey's AT-AT. There were a lot of other things why she was left there, the timing of it in regards to what happened at the Academy and before. Like, there were a lot of things that just Han essentially knowing who Rey was, talking to Maz. There were a lot of things that Abrams left huge clues on that Rian Johnson completely cast aside, and because he felt like the plot needed to have Rey come from nowhere. And in Rian's defense, throughout all of history, all of Jedi history, the exception is Luke and to a lesser extent Leia coming from a Jedi father, right? Like, Jedis are born through the Force. They come from average parents. They come from nowhere. And that's why the last shot of the film is this kid with a broomstick using the Force ability to pull the broomstick to him, because he is a nobody. He's just a stable hand on this planet that he's completely left behind.
Yeah, that we have nothing invested in, though. I mean, I understand the concept of what he's trying to say. He had it teed up. I agree with everything you said. Like, I can understand Luke being frustrated, but if I would have been hired to do it, I would have said it's a race against time for... What about the Knights of Ren? Like, that wasn't even discussed in here. We don't even have a... That was, like, a huge deal about the first movie. And just imagine the race against time of, we need you to become more than you are Daisy Ridley and, you know, Rey. And you need to become a Jedi before they get to this island, because I cannot beat these guys. And you bring the Knights of Ren to that island with Kylo Ren, and you have this epic battle of Luke and Rey. And Luke just showing, that's what, to me, the most frustrating thing about this whole thing is the only Star Wars movies where, I love Return of the Jedi for several reasons, but one of them is the whole bard scene where you actually get to see Luke just kicking ass. And we didn't get it. We didn't get it here. We didn't get to see him kick ass. We didn't, the culmination of all his years of Jedi training should have happened with him dispatching every member of the Knights of Ren and then barely getting off the island, or whatever you want to do from that point forward, and then setting it up for an epic battle against, you know, Snoke in Episode 9. But
Fred, we got that scene. It was just with Rey and Kylo in the throne room. It just was not what we expected, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't Luke. It wasn't this guy that we loved.
It wasn't Luke. I know. And that's the thing. Here's the other big thing about people who were massive Star Wars fans going into Episode 8, and certainly ones who grew up on the original trilogy, is Luke is iconic. Luke is the hero. And now, in terms of this franchise, they've killed off Han, they've killed off Luke, they essentially have to write Leia out, respect to Carrie Fisher, and so but they were never going to get happy endings. Like, that's the other thing. When this was announced 5 years ago, however long ago it was, you knew going into it that you weren't going to get happy endings, because happy endings don't make for interesting films.
Yeah. No, I think that probably, though, I'm pretty sure that if they knew, you know, Carrie Fisher was going to pass away, I don't think they would have killed off Luke. I think you're right. I think you kind of touched on something. I think they wanted each one of those three major characters to die in every movie, but they would have done it differently then and had Carrie Fisher, so a sacrifice for the greater good from each one of those characters, and which would have been great. But that kind of, in their defense, I'm sure that kind of screwed up the plan. But we could talk about this for decades, my man. And maybe we should do another All Star Wars podcast.
I'd be down with that. I could talk Star Wars anytime. There really doesn't a day go by that, at least with my Twitter account, I don't make either a Star Wars or Lord of the Rings reference at some point.
That's right. I do enjoy those from you. And I think, what was the ones I saw the other day that were really impressive? But I'm glad that you were able to catch on to that with the O'Donnell interview. There wasn't a lot of people that were trying to get to the, what I was trying to go for there. And I'm glad you were able to catch on to the subtle.
Ricky is now the chosen one.
Take it easy. My man, what are we pubbing? What are we pubbing as we head out and we close this up? What's the?
Yeah, well, we got a few things. We've got a new app, NBC Sports app. So it's called the My Teams app. If you go to the Google or Apple stores, just search for My Teams. It'll be the first thing that comes up. We've got essentially specific content related to all the Chicago teams that you love. And so if you're only a Bulls fan and you don't like any of the other teams, then you can just essentially have your settings that I just want Bulls information. And what we do is all of our best content, from the podcast to our video breakdowns to our articles, will go on the app, and you will get just that Bulls content. And if you are a Bulls and Bears fan, you can choose just Bulls and Bears. It's awesome. A really, really cool thing. It's pretty nice. And certainly the other thing that you are completely familiar with is we started a new show after the post-game show called Bulls Outsiders, which has been a really huge success so far. I'm very happy with where the show is. Essentially, it's four fans by fans, and we have three massive Bulls fans, and Matt Peck, David Watson, and John Sabine, essentially giving their own spin on what we saw on that nightly basis. It's not X's and O's. It's not another post-game show. It's three fans who just watched the game talking about what they saw.
Yeah, it's great. And anyone who listens to this podcast is very familiar with Big Dave, and we go way back. I can't say enough great things about, you know, all the guys on the show, but especially Dave, who's one of my good friends. And I'm every time I watch it, I'm so excited and happy that this guy who has so much Bulls knowledge, so much love for Ben Gordon, we're very simpatico on a lot of issues. Is able to share his thoughts, so it's good stuff.
Yeah, and we're going to see you on Bulls Outsiders in January.
I'm the Jabari Parker of Bulls Outsiders, man. I got to come off the bench.
Yeah. You're coming off the bench. You're going to be on, January 14th? You're coming
12th,
on with us?
January 12th. I'm looking forward to that night. It'll be a lot of fun, but everybody check out this show because it's fantastic. I was on Facebook. I watch on Facebook every night, and I love it. I'm able to throw my comments out.
Yeah, it's on our main channel after the Bulls post-game show, but we also simulcast it on Facebook Live because a huge part of the show is interacting with fans in real time about what they think. Yeah, so we've gotten some fantastic comments and questions and that the guys have responded to, and that's the whole idea is every night that these three guys talk about the Bulls game, but also react to what the fans are thinking in that moment, too.
I got to change my Facebook name. I don't think they recognize these brilliant questions I'm throwing out there because they haven't picked any of mine yet, but hopefully in the next show I'll be on there.
Well, what's your Facebook name? Is it something you're
Pfeiffer.
Willing to share?
Frederick Pfeiffer. It's my real name. But maybe they're looking for C-Red Fred or something. I don't know. And I got a picture of Fred Rogers, too. So maybe that's why. The picture is of
funny.
Fred Rogers. So, but, yeah, I'll keep them coming. They got to ask. I had a lot of Jabari stuff in there, et cetera. But it's all good, man. I can't recommend the show enough. And these are all three guys are great guys. I mean, and Kev, you're the best, brother. Thanks for jumping on the Bullseye. Lots of great info in this cast. I'm looking forward to having you on again soon.
Anytime, Fred.